This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this special CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by experts from across our investment team to discuss the latest developments in the banking sector. On our panel, we have Sonia Loud, CIO, Colin Reedy, Head of Active Strategies, Christopher Jeffrey, Head of Rates and Inflation Strategy, Dan Lustig, Senior Credit Analyst, and Tim Drayson, Head of Economics. Well, Sonia, we've gathered today for our second call since Friday because of the sheer volume of news flow for investors to digest. Can you walk us through the latest events in Switzerland and in the US?
Thank you, Max, and a very warm welcome to all our clients who are dialing in again. And we believe that clearly the news flow warrants an update on where we are. And you've seen that we have added another expert to the panel in Tim Drayson, because clearly what we want to focus on today is the implication, and obviously not only on the economy, but on markets. And as such, we felt we can update you today. Now, what we have learned over the weekend is one thing in particular, that is that authorities are determined to avoid a Lehman-style moment of protected financial instability. And what we have seen over the weekend gives us reason to believe that they have the tools to do so. And obviously, I'm talking about the UBS takeover of Credit Suisse, and Dan Lustig will walk us through the details and the consequences of the merger that was announced over the weekend. But it's not just the events in Switzerland. We clearly have had over the past week or so quite a few developments in the US, and we should not forget that the actual stresses started when SVB failed to keep depositors in-house. And as such, obviously, we have seen a modern format of the bank run, which now, as we know, happens online, but clearly added an enormous amount of stress and a fight for deposits, which has led the Fed and the government to step in. And we will talk about this as well. Now, for the time being, it seems that we have been able to restore trust. And if you look at the market this morning, again, it seems a far more positive tone is taking hold. And I'm stressing that idea that for the time being, we assume that trust has been restored, because we know that the financial system is based on trust. And it's very clear that the authorities have been very keen to demonstrate that they are here to keep their trust alive and that they have the tools to do so. So the key questions for investors from here clearly are threefold. One is the economic impact, and Tim will walk us through this, because it's obviously been a very lively debate since the beginning of the year already, and we have to understand whether the recent developments will change anything in our economic narrative. And with that, it's not just obviously the growth aspect, but inflation as well, because that is the second very important question, whether the monetary policy reaction function will change on the back of the events we have seen. And Chris Jeffrey will share our recent thoughts on this. And then last but not least, but most important for investors, is the market right? So what we're seeing currently in equity and bond markets, are these a good reflection of what we think is going to unfold with regards to the fundamentals? Because we should not forget, if you slam hard on the brakes, the chances are that something will in fact break. Over the past 70 years, every hiking cycle has either led to a recession or a banking crisis or both. And 2022 has seen the fastest hiking cycle in 40 years from the Fed. So the assumption has to be that clearly interest rates still work, even with a lag. And for us, this is a really key moment to reassess what our fundamental picture looks like and whether we need to make changes with regards to those scenarios. Now, obviously, as we know, forecasting is incredibly difficult. The level of uncertainty that we are operating in is such that we like to work in scenarios, because there's not a clear path from here. But clearly, the stresses that have been emerging is telling us that interest rates do work. And it's now all about understanding how the path looks like from here.
Well, thank you for that overview, Sonia. Calm for now in the market, but with lots of questions for investors. It's a great moment to turn to Dan. Dan, what are the parameters of that deal with UBS? And what does it mean for the holders of Credit Suisse debt and the broader banking sector?
Thanks for your question, Mark. So in terms of the parameter of the deal, the forced combinations of UBS and Credit Suisse over the weekend by the Swiss authorities was done quickly. And as part of this deal, UBS agreed to buy Credit Suisse for just $3 billion. It's an all-share transactions, which the deal does not require any shareholder approval due to the emergency closing of the deal. At the same time, the Swiss regulator has written down 16 billion Swiss franc of capital instruments, while at the same time, the Swiss National Bank provided significant liquidity to support the Swiss, to support Credit Suisse and UBS. And the Swiss authority also provided protection against losses of up to 9 billion Swiss francs. In terms of the broader impact on the banking sector, in our opinion, Credit Suisse was a unique case of a bank in the middle of a restructuring with a profitability issue linked to a loss-making investment bank. Credit Suisse also has a concentrated deposit base. These deposits were mostly uninsured and very sensitive to market movement. And with rising concern in the market, they face significant deposit outflow. The good news is that this is a unique case that has been dealt with. We don't see any other European bank that have a similar problem in terms of both profitability and a concentrated deposit base. So we don't think that we are going to experience the same deposit runs in Europe that we are currently seeing in the US with the regional banks. In terms of Credit Suisse bondholder, there was a good outcome for senior debt that avoided a Lehman moment, is that senior debt holder didn't take any losses. And this is quite important because Credit Suisse had a significant amount of senior debt instrument outstanding and due to a too big to fail Swiss regulations. The bad news was with the writing down of the AT1 instrument. An AT1 instrument is an hybrid instrument between equity and debt, and its purpose is to absorb losses in case of stresses. AT1 ranks senior to equity holder, but junior to debt holder. The big surprise was that the Swiss authority has written down 16 billion Swiss francs of AT1, while at the same time they still pay 3 billion Swiss franc to equity holder. Clearly, the Swiss regulator didn't respect the hierarchy of claim. The bond documentations allowed them to do this, but this was still a surprise, as expectations were that they will follow the Swiss rules and the ranking of priority. The wipeout of this instrument is negative for bank capital structure, especially the AT1 that were down yesterday between 3 and 8 cash points. Higher AT1 costs would result in higher risk premium for bank capital. To calm the market, yesterday, both the Bank of England and the ECB confirmed that under their resolution regime, they will respect the hierarchy of claim, which was a bit reassuring from this asset class. Just to sum it up, Credit Suisse was a unique case, and we don't see other European banks with the same issue. Nonetheless, we expect European banks to be impacted with higher capital.
Well, thanks very much, Dan, for talking through those dynamics. So less concern about contagion risk in Europe, at least. And let's return to that question about capital structure and hierarchy of claims later in the call. Tim, how might banking stress affect the economic outlook, both in Europe and globally?
Thank you, Max. Well, let's assume the authorities have done the right thing here and they've stabilised the situation. We're still in a very late cycle environment. We're still dealing with an underlying inflation problem. That's why we've seen this incredibly aggressive monetary tightening that Sonia mentioned. Now, we'd already witnessed a tightening of bank lending standards through the first quarter. Now, despite what was back then a relatively benign market environment, and we've been warning for some time the recession is likely in the second half of the year because central banks are absolutely convinced they need to slow growth in order to squeeze inflation out of the system. I think the recent events, it's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it probably means the peak interest rates doesn't need to be quite as high, But that's only because the banks are now going to do some of the tightening for the central banks. So we will see renewed tightening of lending standards across the US, across Europe, as a result of this episode. I think that is likely to be the catalyst to push us into recession in the second part of the year.
Let's turn to Chris now. Chris, as you mentioned on Friday that we've seen some extraordinary moves in the government bond market, particularly last week. Is the rates market correctly pricing in the outlook that Tim has just described for the global economy?
Yeah, so let's just put some of the numbers around that, Max. So last week, we were kind of talking about the movement in two-year bond yields, but maybe an easier kind of frame of reference is what's the pricing for the trajectory of policy rates over the next 12 months or so. In the US, in the space of about a week, we've gone from pricing the best part of 100 basis points of additional cuts, 50 basis points of additional cuts to 100 basis, again, my language mixed up here, 50 basis points of additional hikes to 100 basis points of cuts by year end. So 150 basis points swing in the December 2023 pricing. In Europe and the UK, it's been directionally the same, but just somewhat smaller magnitude. The UK has gone from pricing a peak in rates at close to 5% to basically a curve which is now flat at 4%. So we're sort of taking out in the UK kind of the pricing for the additional kind of push higher in Bank of England policy rates. Is that reasonable? Well, there's a kind of couple of things that have been said by other speakers. Dan's talking about a higher risk premium for bank capital. Ultimately, authorities care about the price that the private sector and the broader economy has to pay for credit. They don't really care that much about the overnight interest rate. That's their policy instrument. But what they care about is the way that that transmits through to the economy. We've heard Christine Lagarde speaking yesterday, despite insisting that there are no kind of structural concerns about the European financial system, telling us that the tightening of financial conditions is now something that they will have to take into account when thinking about their policy setting. So clearly, the kind of creep of rhetoric from central banks has now started, that we're going to be hearing more and more about this kind of tightening of financial conditions and what it might mean. A couple of ways of maybe trying to quantify that. We can look historically about what this sort of tightening of financial conditions has implied. We think it's worth something in the order of 50 basis points on the front end from those sort of historical calibrations. Or we can, I'm sure Colin's going to come on and talk about this, we can look at the movement in credit spreads. So credit spreads in the US have moved something like 50 basis points on the back of this. All else equal, that would imply a kind of trajectory for policy rates, which is around 50 basis points lower. So the swings are probably bigger than we anticipated, but they're not wildly bigger than we anticipated. And so this kind of represents, whilst we're in this period of waiting to find out how much central bankers are going to want to focus on this, and obviously we'll find out a lot more this week with the Bank of England meeting and the Federal Reserve meeting, I think that kind of market pricing adjustment looks pretty reasonable to us.
Thanks, Chris. And I see we've actually already had a few live questions about central banks, so we'll return to that theme later in the call. Let's turn to Colin now. Colin, has our thinking on positioning evolved given this flurry of events? And to Dan's points earlier, do investors now need to think differently about prioritization within the capital structure?
I actually rewatched last week's webinar last night to remind myself what I actually said, because the intervening period has been a bit of a blur, to be honest. And I noticed that I finished with a rather dramatic comment about hell is probably warming up. Well, I didn't expect to be speaking on another webinar so soon, but I can confirm it's probably just got a little bit hotter. If I may, Max, I'll take the second part first. But I have to admit that it's quite difficult for a credit investor like me to answer, because I'm pretty conflicted here. So I'll get my rant about the ripping up of the capital structure rules seen as doctrine since the late 50s out of the way first. Such were the scars left by these types of bonds during the financial crisis. You know, they were referred to weapons of mass destruction for credit portfolios back in 2007, 2008. It actually took over a decade of pretty intense debate to finally come up with some form of resolution mechanism for failed sort of financial institutions. And that just went up in smoke in a week and a half. So we found it pretty revealing that both the EU and UK regulators came out pretty swiftly yesterday to remind investors that their bank resolution regimes cannot be written down before equity, which probably tells you how closely they're watching the situation and how concerned they probably are. But I think that the lesson has to be, when you have your Lehman moment and regulators are sort of backed into a corner by markets, events, and systematically or systemically important banks, anything can go, anything can happen, basically. And the rules that you thought were in place to safeguard, you know, client capital, client investments, can be brushed to one side pretty swiftly in the name of the greater good. And then just, you know, other things that have taken place here that are worth sort of dipping into a little bit. Let's just dwell on the G of ESG for a second. You know, a bank has just merged with another bank without any shareholder approval whatsoever. I mean, we've lived through a period of extraordinary financial and capital market manipulation for the last 15 years. You could argue longer, yet we still continue to push it, you know, when the going gets tough or it's deemed necessary. To the first part of your question, you know, Tim's highlighted that these events will, you know, run the risk of bringing forward, you know, the onset of recession. We spoke here last week about, you know, the one thing we could say almost for certain at that juncture, and that was that all developed market or Western banks will be tightening their lending criteria and withdrawing credit from the economy as we spoke. But, you know, given the actions that Credit Suisse have taken, or the Swiss regulator have taken, by forcing losses into the public credit markets channel, you know, in wiping out entire debt instruments like these, you add the global credit markets to the growing list of entities that that naturally provide credit to the capital system. We're either no longer going to do it or we'll be charging considerably more for it going forward. So I don't think our positioning will change much. No, we'll carry on improving, you know, credit quality and taking advantage of tactical opportunities where we can. You know, credit spreads have moved a long way in a very, you know, short period of time. You know, markets have had a big shock over the weekend. And, you know, in euros and senior banks, for example, that's the other end of the quality spectrum to 81 and COCOs. They're now trading at similar spreads to, you know, senior non-financials or corporate debt. You know, we haven't seen these kind of levels in the European sovereign crisis. So there will be opportunities, and I think it's important to be nimble.
Well, thanks very much for that perspective, Colin, and I'm sure everyone would agree about the importance of being nimble at times like this. Now is a great time to turn to some of the live questions we've received from our clients, and as on Friday, quite a lot have come in. Sonia, let's put the first one on to you. This asks, what's the outlook for equities from here?
Yeah, that's a very important question, Max. And obviously, if every listener, having just been through what we have said, will ask the very obvious questions: why are equities up? So if indeed, you know, we are right with what we have just said, then there is a mismatch between the price action from the credit market and the bond market overall versus the price action in equity markets. And I think as we speak, Europe is still up around 10% year to date. So there clearly is something in there which is wrong. And we have been at these junctures before where we see the asset classes moving in different directions. And we have said very consistently since the beginning of the year that we still believe that there's a better entry point into equities. Equities will not be able to continue this positive trajectory if indeed we're right and the recession will occur in the second half of this year. This will inevitably lead to lower earnings revisions and lower earnings. And as such, we do expect that equities will be lower and that there's a better entry point at some point this year. Now, the question is, why are equities more positive? What has it been in the recent announcements that leads equities to believe that there's a better path forward? And it has to be linked to particularly the Fed action and the action around the deposit guarantee, where clearly there's again more liquidity provided to the system. But it's very important to understand this is not quantitative easing. the central bank is lending to the economy, is providing liquidity to banks. This is not the same than buying, obviously, securities off banks and hence, obviously, providing the deposit and the liquidity at the bank level. So it's very interesting. It's not 100% clear whether this is indeed driving the narrative around equities, that in fact, we have another QE form that is supporting equities. And I would really warn investors to be very mindful that the fundamental facts are not in favor of a continued positive trajectory of equities.
Okay, thanks for that, Sonia. Let's turn to our next question, which I think is probably for you, Colin. This one asks, sterling credit markets have a higher exposure to banking and real estate than the global credit market. Should this be a concern to investors?
I don't think so. Max, at this stage of the cycle turning points heading into downturns, it's kind of all about your bottom-up stock selection. You know, you need to be in the right names. And as you know, I think we mentioned on the webinar last week, you know, we do think this is a somewhat unique situation, and that most banks, you know, particularly EU banks, are actually in relatively good shape from a capital and profitability perspective. We talked about, you know, the ECB obviously having exited negative rates being a tailwind for bank profitability. So, I mean, they make up, you know, financial institutions, I think, will make up, you know, close to sort of 40-50% of these indices. And you know, and this is why aggregate indices have moved wider quite so much, because there's been such a powerful driver in terms of a weighting. But no, I feel overly concerned. I mean, there are some names that are probably lower quality and that may well struggle, but you know, I think most names are in reasonable shape.
Thanks, Colin. Some reasons for some optimism, qualified optimism there. Chris, right, let's go to you and the next question, which asks, have we seen developed market government bond yields peak for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, you can always risk making yourself hostage to fortune on these kind of calls, but my answer would be yes. And the yes is based upon the fact that, you know, the pattern during previous hiking cycles is central banks hike rates until something breaks. And then when something breaks, they try and fix it. That feels like quite a good template for what's going on, particularly in the US at the moment, that we're having, you know, these day by day stories around volatility around particular regional bank shares. Dan will be much better placed to comment on this than me, but there are genuine kind of solvency concerns swirling around sectors of the US banking sector after the repricing of rates that we've seen. We're having, you know, debates around extending federal deposit insurance to larger and larger portions of the US banking sector against a backdrop of a political environment which makes it incredibly hard to get the necessary regulation through Congress. So, you know, discussion overnight about regulators finding a route around congressional approval. So just be clear about what that means. That means trying to do an end run around the people who have democratic responsibility for deciding how public funds should be committed. So we're in, you know, quite stressed times in the US banking sector, and it's pretty hard to think that doesn't then translate into an impact on credit growth and then an impact on terminal policy rates. We get weekly data. I think, like, you know, there's one thing to be watching. I'd say it's the weekly data that comes out of the Federal Reserve, both on their own balance sheet, will kind of give us an idea of the extent of discount window borrowing that they're needing to provide in order to kind of keep the liquidity, to meet the liquidity needs of the US regional banks. And we also get data on commercial banks' balance sheets every week in the H4 and H8. So, you know, mind your H's over the next couple of weeks. And that second one in particular will give us a way of trying to quantify, well, how much system level deposit flight are we actually talking about? So within the smaller lenders, so far at the system level, we haven't seen a great deal, but the kind of suspicion is that that's going to start coming through pretty rapidly. So my answer is yes. The thing that would kind of make me rip up that answer and start again is if we genuinely get a move towards kind of fiscal stimulus of some kind. That seems incredibly remote, given the congressional divide, the debates around the debt ceiling that we still, you know, if we'd said 2 weeks ago, you know, what's the sort of tail risk that you could start to worry about quite rapidly, it'd be the US debt ceiling debate. we haven't even got to that yet. I mean, that's still pending. Tim, I'm sure we'll talk about how this has accelerated the timetable a bit, but that sort of fiscal gridlock is still there.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Chris. And yes, let's turn to Tim now. Tim, we've had a couple of questions about what you expect from this week's Fed and BOE meetings. And I'll just add in another question we've had about bank lending, which asks, is bank lending less important now than in 2008?
So 2 weeks ago, the debate would have been between 25 and 50 basis points hikes. And that's what Powell was setting us up for at his congressional testimony. The Fed meetings, two-day meetings, is starting in a few hours. We'll get the result Wednesday evening in the UK. The debate's now clearly shifted between 0 and 25. Obviously, the Fed don't want to see non-linear events such as bank runs. That's a very uncontrolled process. But they're still looking to tighten financial conditions in a sort of steady way. So they're definitely not trying to reflate the economy at this juncture. So that echoes back to Sonia's comment, which is a bit careful about equity market reacting to perceptions around QE. That is most definitely not their intention here. I think as long as markets remain calm over the next 24, 36 hours, they will deliver that 25 basis point hike. I think they may be able to get one more through, and then we'll start to see evidence that these tighter bank lending standards are beginning to impinge more dramatically on the economy. And when we get evidence that the labour market is turning and recession is indeed unfolding, that's when the Fed can go on hold. Interestingly, and as Chris mentioned, that the market's pricing cuts for later on in the year. Now, that is possible, but only in an environment where we get a recession and a big earnings disappointment. So again, this kind of disconnect between the equity market, assuming that the Fed's going to kind of reliquify everything, and then the bond market suggesting rate cuts are coming to the rescue. I think that is a tension which is yet to be resolved. I do think the credit channel is really important here. We place a lot of emphasis on bank lending standards in our recession indicators. We've been expecting a tightening of lending standards that came through in the first quarter. That's why we've been anticipating a recession in the second part of the year. In terms of the Bank of England, that's a kind of trickier one. The market's kind of 50-50 whether or not they go ahead on Thursday with another 25 basis point hike. I think the Monetary Policy Committee are concerned about the lags of the already delivered timing, particularly in UK residential property. A lot of mortgages are on two-year fixes, only just starting to roll off. And homeowners suffering from much higher mortgage rates. So they may want to tread a bit more carefully. But again, the UK has an underlying inflation problem. They're not in a position to pivot to rate cuts anytime soon, unless we see kind of a material drop in activity and rise in unemployment.
Thank you very much for that, Tim. Big week for markets, big week for central bankers as well. Sonia, let's turn to you for our next question, which asks, are the regulations adopted after the global financial crisis to avoid these situations still fit for purpose?
Yeah, it is a very important question. And I think this is why Dan has stressed several times that clearly the failures we have seen are quite distinct cases. One, obviously, in the US, when we look at SVB and their depositor base, and then likewise Credit Suisse, which is a rather challenged business model. And we've outlined on the call on Friday that clearly this has been a restructuring case for a number of years. And that is important because that it has to be the assumption that the rest of the sector is still solid. And we obviously are talking a lot about the level of at core tier one, so the capitalization, the liquidity positions, the regulation around these. But obviously, what we have been talking about in the US in particular is this flight of deposits from the smaller regional banks towards the global systematic important financial institutions because of the different levels of support. And this is something that will need to be addressed. I think we've always assumed that regulation will evolve. No crisis is equal to the other or the same. And as such, there will always be nuances that regulators will pick up. But this is why I started with the fact that regulators and governments really are determined to restore trust, because the biggest learning clearly from the global financial crisis is the longer you wait, the more you lose trust. And that is what will ultimately bring the financial system down. Whether the tools are always adequate, we've just discussed at length what the Swiss have done and how others probably would do it. But it's probably the reaction function, how swiftly they were able to react, that has been the key ingredient here. And I would expect that there will be further evolution and nuances in the way how regulators will look at what has been unfolding this time round. But for the time being, we have to assume that it's more the fundamentals that will matter going forward than another step at renewed banking regulation.
Thanks for that, Sonia. Let's turn to our final question here, which I think is one for you, Dan. This asks, how much attention should we pay to CDS?
Yes, and maybe to answer this question, I explain briefly how banks fund themselves. The bank funding structure comprises of deposits, wholesale funding, which is funding from the market like issuance of bonds, and equity. Most banks fund a large part of the lending through deposit. Now, unlike a normal company, banks use a greater proportion of debt funding rather than equity funding, because the bank business model is based on borrowing from depositor and the wholesale markets. And with this borrowing, they create loans. So going back to your question on credit default swap, it's a very important barometer of the health of the wholesale funding market. Credit default swaps spread are treated as a proxy for long-term funding costs. And if these are very elevated, it means that the banks will struggle to fund itself in the wholesale market. And at the same time, we might see that short-term funding will be withdrawn. Needless to say that this could result in a liquidity crunch, as was evident with Credit Suisse.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Dan, for talking that through. Well, Sonia, we have covered a large amount today on a very fast-moving story. Before we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, let me try and provide just a very, very brief summary, because to our mind, the framework of analysis is incredibly important in making sure we can place events, and there will be more events, in the right context of how these events can potentially influence the trajectory of the underlying economy. And it's very clear that we have said for some time clearly that interest rates do work and they will matter. But we have clearly seen that the financial stresses in the system are just another sign of the cycle coming to an end. And we have to assume that more will break. There will be more stresses in the system, because clearly we haven't seen the full impact, which will now be exacerbated by ever tighter lending standards and obviously the bank's reaction function on how they provide credit to the economy. This is incredibly important in understanding and assessing whether current market pricing already reflects a realistic picture of that trajectory. And then on top, you will obviously add what Chris and Colin have said, particularly around the central bank reaction function and whether we have a clearer picture on where we're heading here. This is why, hopefully, it's clear scenario analysis is very important, because we don't know for certain yet. There's a high degree of uncertainty. And again, today, we haven't even talked about the geopolitical situation, which is another level and layer of uncertainty on top of everything else. Sticking to a disciplined framework, to our mind, is key in order to get to the right investment decisions. And finally, I think what Colin has said is incredibly important. Given that we assume that more will break, your stock-specific, bond-specific, and issue analysis is key to success, because there will be winners and losers in every downturn and in every turning point. And given where we are in the cycle, there is real opportunities to get this one right.
Well, thank you for that, Sonia. That's an important and sobering point on which to end today's webinar. Thank you to our panel for your insights on these developments, and to you, our clients, for joining us. You can receive even more analysis from us at LGIM on the situation as it unfolds on our blog, on LGIM Talks, our podcast, and on our other social media channels.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2022. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the license corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.